Good morning. Thanks to everybody for being here bright and early after a late night last night. The committee will come to order. A quorum is present. And, let's see, do we have minutes in here? Okay. All right, so glad to see Representative Norton in the room. Representative Norton, we're going to start with your bills. So, we're going to start this morning with, we're going to start with House File 1448. And members, just so you understand what we're doing and in the audience here, and boy, how amazing to see so many people packing this room so early after a late night session. It's really impressive. We have 1448, and then there's sort of a related bill, which is House File 1586, which we had expected we would have both bills before us today, but we don't. We only have 1448. And so what we're going to do, members, is we're going to sort of discuss both of those together because they're related bills, even though only 1448 is before us. And then the other one, 1586, has gone straight to the Finance Committee. And our plan originally was to discuss both bills, move them to the Finance Committee so that there can be some coordination between them. But since we only have one of them before us, it really doesn't make any difference. We can still discuss them both. Representative Norton and her testifiers can help us understand the issues, and which are very important and need to be resolved this session. And then we're going to hopefully vote Representative Norton's bill, 1448, out to the Finance Committee, where we will again take up the issue and try to resolve it with both bills in front of us, in front of that committee, I should say. So, on Representative Norton's behalf, I will move 1448, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we also have 1586 in our packets, members, but as I said, that is not actually before this committee. So, Representative Norton, did we have any amendments or anything like that we need to take care of at the outset?
I don't believe we do, Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of anyway.
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Madam Chairs and members, thank you very much for hearing House File 1448. This is a Department of Human Services bill that contains the department's proposal for the disability waiver rate setting system.
And Representative Norton, you might need to move that mic a little bit.
It doesn't move any further. Maybe it could be turned up. How to do that? Is that better, Madam Chair? Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So again, House File 1448 is the Department of Human Services bill that contains the department's proposed disability waiver rate setting system. And as you mentioned, there is a second bill that is a variation of that bill that was put together by some stakeholders, and we can talk about that a little bit later. The objective of the rate setting system is to create a statewide rate setting methodology for disability waiver services that are transparent, fair, consistent across the state, and yet capture the individualized nature of the services being provided. It's to promote quality and participation choice. We need to meet federal requirements for the administration of waivered programs, and we need to establish rates based on a uniform process of structuring component values for services. Last year, the legislature passed language that directed the Department of Human Services to spend another year working with stakeholders, gathering more data related to the system, and to propose language to implement the new disability waiver rate system. The bill you have before you is the result of that year's work by the department and by stakeholders. Staff are here from the department to testify on the bill's content, and then we can discuss a little bit the differences between the two bills and answer any questions that you might have, committee members. And so with that, Alex Bartolik from the Department of Human Services is here, and she can provide further testimony and answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norton. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik. I am with the Department of Human Services, and I noticed that there is a PowerPoint that was one of the handouts that explains a little bit more about home and community-based services. And home and community-based services have been very successful in helping us close institutions and help people with disabilities be able to live in their homes and communities, work, and be able to have full community participation. We have 94% of people with disabilities in Minnesota live in their community with support services such as that's provided through these waivers. We have 4 disability waivers, 1 for people with developmental disabilities, the DD waiver. We have the CADI, which is the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, which is for people who might be at risk of a nursing home level of care placement. We have 1 for people with brain injury and 1 for people that are at hospital level of care. And they're called waivers because when it first started, we were able to waive federal requirements and give CMS our own plan for how we would make certain assurances for the use of Medicaid for these services. As it was explained in 2007, the federal government, the Centers for Medicare and Medicare Services, on reviewing one of our waiver plans for renewal, we renew them every 5 years, told us that they had questions about how we were making services available, and in fact, they determined that we were out of compliance with federal law. They said that our use, in a nutshell, they said that our use of counties to contract with providers, the use of counties to determine that providers are able to meet people's needs and have adequate standards, and the use of counties to set rates was against the law. It was putting an artificial barrier between providers and the state, and that the state needed to directly enroll providers, the state needed to have consistent provider standards, and the state needed to establish consistent rate-setting methodologies so that people across the state could have access of any qualified provider and that there was consistency and very predictability in the rates that would be used. Now, this was not new. We had been working on some of the rates. We knew that there was a lot of variation across the state for rates for similar services, and people who use services wanted more information about their services and what they cost and wanted some more choice and control. But in 2007 and then 2008, when we had to enter a corrective action plan, we were on a timeline where we had to do things, or CMS was not going to continue to approve federal participation in our programs. Over this past year, as Representative Norton said, we worked with stakeholders. Stakeholders put in over 4,000 hours in different work groups and advisory groups. There was a tremendous amount of work that went into it. We worked on the things we were required to do with legislation, and we also talked about other issues that arose. For example, we grouped services into 4 service areas so we could look at similar services and the types of frameworks. We looked at how the legislation required rates that are developed through the methodology to be designed in such a way that spending is equivalent to projected spending under current law. And so we needed to figure out a budget neutrality by these service areas. We also needed to provide recommendation for the final frameworks and the values that would fill those up to the legislature. And this is talking about if you build a rate, a prospective rate, that's supposed to be appropriate enough to support people, what are the factors that providers have to take into account in order to provide the service, and what are we putting into the methodology? We also researched specific topics that were in the legislation. Some of that included what is going to be a data-driven process for really determining labor costs that could be predictable so we could report to you things are getting more expensive and show you the information behind that. And also looking at whether there were underlying differences in the cost to provide services around the state. We had stakeholders participating in all of the analysis, development of recommendations, and legislative language. We also found, and we recognize that as you work with some stakeholders, there's a lot of people who also have not been as involved. So communication has always been a challenge to try to help everybody understand what is under consideration. Counties and lead agencies worked with providers to give us data to help us understand how current services will be priced. And we used a number of different tools to help simulate the effect of changing different values so we could understand the total effect of this methodology. In the end, we want a system that reflects participants' needs, that's going to be sensitive to their needs so that providers can successfully serve them. We want to recognize reasonable and necessary costs of providers. We want to provide fiscal stability for providers as well as for the state. We want to have a process that can facilitate regular updates so we don't go through this every time that there's a question about are rates adequate. And we also wanted to increase the transparency of how rates are developed. House File 1448 establishes procedures for calculating rates in the four service areas. Now, the four service areas are residential. These are things like foster care and supported living, where there's shared staffing, and it includes a component to cover the basic types of staffing and expenses of managing, for example, a foster home, but also allows for individualized staffing to be intense, more intense if people have those needs. There also is a service grouping around day services, and this is day training and habilitation or adult daycare. Again, often these have shared staffing, but they need to be individualized to the person and to the type of service that's being delivered. There's a service grouping around unit price services that have programming. This might be something like independent living skills or supported employment, where you need to have people who are skillful at assessment, helping people learn new skills, being able to understand what's going on. It's a one-on-one relationship with a person. It's a lot of independence, often in the community without others. And then unit-based without programming are things like night supervision or companion care, where we need to have a rate that is adequate to support it, but we're not expecting the same level of training. The bill also establishes a procedure for moderating the provider rate changes to 1% a year, up or down 1%, for 3 years to allow for a phase-in period and to reduce any potential negative impact, but recognizing that some providers will have at rates that increase and some that will decrease. It implements the new rate system beginning January 1st, 2014. Just to give you a little bit of background around that date, last year, we had to work with CMS to delay the implementation. They did agree to 2014. They have been monitoring our progress and have told us that they will not renew any of our waiver plans that are up for renewal until they are assured that we will be able to implement 2014. And the reasonable progress they're looking for is actually legislative action moving these bills forward. So right now, our DD waiver plan was up for renewal in July of 2012. We're operating under extensions, and they've now not approved our CAC waiver plan. We're operating under an extension. So we have that pressure that's facing us. The bill establishes a procedure to apply a budget neutrality adjustment for rates in each service area. And as I said, there was agreement last year in the legislation that by service area, we wanted the spending under this system to be equitable to what was expected to be spent under the old system. And so when you apply a consistent methodology across all of our services, we can come up budget neutral across all the programs, but we have to pay attention to each service budget. So we have a factor to help assure that we can meet that. There's a procedure for updating or changing payment values over time. There's also a means for addressing extraordinary needs of people that cannot be met under the rate system. And in fact, since this bill was drafted, we have continued to work with stakeholders, and we have additional criteria and procedures that we can look at adding in later to the bill. The bill also highlights those areas of rate components that we've termed interim values, which will require further research. So we have something that we can begin with. The budget neutrality factor will assure that the money still stays in service areas while we look at it. Overall, there were a lot of agreements. Compared to where we were a year ago, we've made a lot of progress in many of the areas. There are still areas of disagreements, and there's still areas that, despite all the work, we simply couldn't reach a recommendation. An example there was a lot of work looking at the geographic differences and a lot of passion for whether that should be a factor or shouldn't be a factor. We just didn't have a recommendation for that. This proposal is budget neutral. We're not spending any more money. We want to spend all the money we're spending today, but we don't have any more money. So simply by applying a statewide methodology, we recognize that this will mean that there will be changes in rates, and we know that that's difficult. we've worked with our stakeholders, and we've had some pretty hard and honest conversations. And I applaud them all. They've come to the table. We've really been able to talk a lot about things and understand each other's viewpoints, and we have a much better product because of that. We want and need our providers to be successful. It is very important. We have a very diverse and breadth of providers in our system that have made it possible for Minnesota to be a leader in home and community-based services, for people with disabilities to live and to work and to play in their communities, and we want that to continue. We are committed to continue working with stakeholders through the session to try to reach agreement where we can, and we're also committed to giving you the best information we have so that you can make decisions as we go forward. So if you'd like, I can walk through the bill section by section. Otherwise, I'm available if you have questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bartolik, and appreciate your work on this. I know this has been a long, hard slog through this, and appreciate that you're listening and trying to respond and that we're working together on this. Representative Norton.
Madam Chair, I will just say I've really appreciated the department's willingness to continue to work and the coalition continuing to work on the other side, and I think we will come together with something. I will just clarify, one of the overriding concerns is the compressed timeline. The department has a concern about meeting the requirements of the federal government, and I think the advocates on the other side believe that by putting something in law that steers us in the direction of getting it done and moving it out just a little bit longer to allow for it to be implemented a little more slowly might be acceptable. And so that is one of the main rubs right now, and we will continue working on that as we move this bill to the floor in the omnibus bill, or however we're going to handle that here in the next few weeks. So the other issue that some of you might have heard, and maybe I'll just address it up front if you don't mind, and that has to do with licensing fees. Those are not in this bill. They're in another bill, but many of you will have received calls. I know a large group of providers is meeting with all the legislators down in my area and concerned about the inequities between corporate foster care and family home care, and that there's a lot of consternation about that particular issue, and I think the department will continue to listen and perhaps make some changes on that as well. But that is not in this bill. I just wanted to kind of clarify that up front because a lot of you have received calls and emails about that.
Thank you, Representative Norton. That's really important to know that we're not dealing with. We've got enough on our plate without dealing with everything that isn't before us. So Right. Thank you very much for that. How would you like to proceed, Representative Norton? Do you want to, we have some other testifiers. Is it time to bring up some of the folks
Certainly.
That might want to talk about the other bill, 1586?
However you'd like to proceed would be fine. I think the department has kind of laid out there nicely, you know, what their intent is and has said that they're willing to talk, and so perhaps it would be nice to have a few speakers.
Okay, well,
table.
It's so, your prerogative, Representative Norton. So,
fine. We
Bruce
want to
Nelson?
Get the issues out here for the
okay,
committee.
Okay, we've got several people who've signed up to testify on the bill, and okay. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lynn Noren. I'm the president of RISE Incorporated, which is an organization that provides employment, housing, and community supports to people with disabilities. We serve over 4,000 people a year at RISE. Our programs and services are really, they work to empower people with disabilities in living self-determined, meaningful lives. We provide services throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area and across central Minnesota. At RISE, we serve nearly 800 people every day that would be impacted by these new rate methodologies, including people with intellectual disabilities, brain injuries, people with mental health conditions, physical disabilities, and people who are deaf or hard of hearing. Most of the people that we serve at RISE have multiple disabilities, and they depend on us for these supports. I've been honored to be part of the stakeholder committee that's been working with the department since 2009 on developing these rate methodologies. Together with other stakeholder groups, we've logged hundreds of hours, as Alex said, working to develop the rate frameworks and processes which will guide this new system. We've done a lot of work in collaboration, And while we've made great progress, there remain a number of significant areas that are yet to be resolved and tested prior to implementation. One key example of the need for additional work on this project was the recent publishing on the DHS website of the actual frameworks that people we serve, agency staff and lead agency staff will use to determine what the rates will be. In testing the rate methodologies for day services, what we noted is that the rates that are showing up in the frameworks are between 40 and 50% lower than current rates that are published. It's possible that there's a problem in the methodology, but it also shows that there are some underlying concerns that are yet to be resolved before moving forward with implementation. I can give you a specific example, and that would be in the area of transportation. Transportation is one of the 30 distinct programs that are affected by these methodologies, and transportation services are a really important link for people with disabilities in their communities, whether that's a ride to work or a ride to just being involved in a community activity. The department is in agreement that we have not gathered enough data to set the rates for transportation accurately. However, moving forward without completing this part of the service framework will impact service delivery for people we serve. Transportation expenses account for about 20% of the daily service rate for most providers. And under the current proposed rate, a two-way trip that today at RISE we would be reimbursed $16 for in the framework shows up as being an average of $7.62 for that same rate. At RISE, we provide transportation to over 650 people each day, and that's their primary access to getting to their jobs. With the increases that we've had in recent years in fuel costs and maintenance, it's just not sustainable for us to move forward under the current proposed rate frameworks. There are other examples of work yet to be completed, such as a detailed exception process, the geographic difference factor, facility use expenses, and a number of other key areas. Many of the details related to how this project would be implemented have yet to be worked out between lead agencies and the department and providers. And so while it's clear we've made great progress developing this system and we're working towards implementation together, we really feel like implementing at this point early in 2014 would cause undue chaos and challenges to the system and, most importantly, to people with disabilities. This rate system will cover services to over 34,000 people with disabilities in Minnesota and uses $2.6 billion in state and federal funds. And we hope that while we all understand that there's pressure to move forward, that certainly a process of this magnitude needs to be carefully planned and implemented. And so we want to make sure that getting it right is much more important than the speed of implementation. The coalition bill provides for additional time to resolve the areas that are not yet completed. Additionally, it would give the department time to work out implementation processes and to do the necessary training that they need to do with providers and lead agencies. And more importantly, it allows for more time for the people that we serve and the providers that serve them to do the necessary work to assure that there's stability in the provider community moving forward. The provider community in Minnesota supports the development of individualized rates. We stand behind that, and we will want to continue to work with the department to finalize and complete the work that's necessary to implement this system. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And could I get you to spell your last name?
Sure. It's N-O-R-E-N.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Noren. Okay. Other testifiers. I have several on the list. I don't know if they're here, if there are other people that want to testify. We've got Stephen Adair. Is he here?
Here.
Would you like to come down, sir? And then I have Bruce Knapper and Linda Holt on my list, and we'll see if if others want to testify as well. Welcome to the committee.
Stephen Adair.
Thank you, Mr. Adair. Please proceed.
Madam Chairman, one of the things that goes with House File 1448 for the family, adult foster care families, is the companion bill, which is 245D, which has not been required of the families before. And 245D has very significant cost increases to the families.
Yeah, Mr. Adair, if I could just stop you. This is what we were discussing before, I believe, that this is not in the bill that we're considering right now. And we do understand that this is a very important topic, but if you could, we'd really prefer to discuss that when that issue is before the committee.
This is about the rate methodology.
Okay, please proceed then.
With the HF 1448 being the rate-setting rule that governs family adult foster care, as well as many other aspects of Harriman Services caregiving, I wish to address the impact it will have on the family adult foster care system when it was rolled out with the 245D rule. The 245D rule is 55 pages of new requirements you are asking family adult foster homes to follow, which is exactly the same as corporate adult foster home care rules as of the 1st of January 2014. By definition, within the 245D rule, the only difference in outcomes or requirements for the clients is that in the family homes is where the license holder lives in the home and is the primary caregiver. By implementing the 245D rule, you are requiring family adult foster homes to give the exact same results as corporate adult foster care when family homes are paid $1,200 to $4,000 per client per month, including the room and board funds. Corporate homes providing the same exact rule requirements are given $6,000 to $10,000 per client per month. If we wish to achieve the additional 55 pages of requirements in Rule 245D for family adult foster care, it will cost a minimum of $2,800 per client per month just to meet the very basics of the requirements of the 245D rule. In the 245D rule, you are adding 14 new costs to the family adult foster care home. I will only list the five costs that are the deal breakers that will cause most family adult foster homes to quit. The policy and procedure manual that is required of the homes that they did not have before will cost $2,000 to either buy it from such organizations as Star Services or pay an independent QMRP to write one for you. 245D requires you to have a college degree staff on your payroll in the following areas. You need a designated manager, a designated coordinator, and a registered nurse to train on medication dispensing. Training requirements of 30 hours of orientation and 40 hours annually thereafter are extreme for these homes that are paid so little. Goal development requires supervisor hours and extra staff time to implement for all of their clients. I have spoken to many family providers, and they feel they could step up to the plate and provide all of the things you are asking for, but these are all new costs to them, and they need funds to pay for them. They cannot be expected to add all these additional items without the funds to pay for them. If there are enough funds to pay for them, most of the family providers will quit, and you will have roughly 1,500 clients that will need to be placed in corporate adult foster care at a much higher per month rate. If you add up these startup costs, it would take 3 months worth of pay for most family homes just to achieve the initial licensing that they would have to do for 245D. That includes their money for room and board, the money to feed the clients, transport the clients, and everything else. We have gotten away with many years where we place clients in the family homes at a very low rate based on the fact that we didn't have these extra high requirements that corporates have. So if you ask the corporates model to be pushed down to families, then you have to pay for the cost. I really feel that what the committee has to look at Do you want 500 homes or more to quit out of the 1,600 homes that are out there? Because most of the providers I've talked to across the state in the last month, they couldn't meet the requirement. They only make $1,200 to $2,000 a month. It'd be $5,000 to initially hit January 1st and pay all the costs to do it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Adair. Appreciate it. Bruce Knapper, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Knapper. I'm a licensed foster provider here in the state of Minnesota in Wright County. It was a rainy ride in this morning. I'm going to speak directly to rates. On Monday of this week, DHS had a webinar that Jenny Lewis put forth, and I appreciate it. She's here. And I appreciated it, learned a lot there. But I was also on a rating committee that she facilitated at DHS that I was a member of. The tool states at one point in there, it rates deafness. I thought that was rather odd that they chose deafness as a disability that they took out and rated specially for that. Why not, well, I don't know, how about blind or how about anything else? It shouldn't have been in there, and it should be taken out. And I'm not the only one that feels this way. I've talked to some corporates, and they can't figure out why it's in there. I'm not going to speak to the fee because you spoke to it, and I appreciate it. I am going to call attention to the professional staffing requirements that it's called for, and there's no line for billing for family. And we all have to hire these professional people because it's going to be in the new rule. And there's not a line there for us to bill with this. And just to pigtail off of Steve Adair's ending comment, and I'm going to end with this, is that the impact of family foster care is real evident. But it's a positive thing for the state. And our numbers are somewhat north of 2,000 if you figured in all the foster care homes. The problem is, I find it odd that now, at a time when we should be increasing those numbers by 5 or 10 times, in the future, 5 to 8 years, or maybe even shorter than that, for the senior onslaught that's going to come in. And that is a viable option, and every licensor in every county knows this. Unfortunately, they're not here because they've been told to keep their head down. And ending, I'd like to say this. This is my first exposure to dealing with you folks. I'd like to think it was a positive one, but it was not. Very few of you took the time to meet with us. Your email addresses, you might as well take them off because I got one response. This lady right here met with us, and she gave us 15 minutes, and I really appreciated that. And she met with the constituents from her area, and I appreciate that. That's all we ask for. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and Mr. Knapper. And I just do want to say that while I know that every member around this table tries very, very hard to meet with the people who try to meet with us and to respond to every email, people need to understand that members receive hundreds and hundreds of emails, and often when there's a contentious issue before us, that number increases dramatically, and just sometimes members just simply can't physically keep up with that. And I know that everybody here bipartisanly does their very best. So, you know, we apologize that if anyone feels that their issue isn't taken care of. And in fact, when a member carries a bill, as Representative Norton has been brave enough to do on this very difficult issue, they kind of act as a point person for all of us. So we appreciate her service ever more in that respect. Are there other people in the audience who want to testify for, or I shouldn't say for or against, but on this issue? Would you like to testify on this issue that's before us on either of these two bills that we're discussing? Okay, seeing none. Questions for members. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, based on the testimony of Stephen Adair and Bruce Knapper, is it the 1448 or the 1586? Which one is causing them consternation on that 245D rule?
Representative Norton, and thank you for the question, Representative Grunhagen. I think it's appropriate to kind of clarify this one.
I do, Norton. And I'm actually carrying both of those bills. So I think their consternation is with the department's 1448. But some of what they talked about is not in that bill. So the department is here, and they have some solutions or some explanation, perhaps that will help illuminate that particular issue that was raised by Mr. Adair.
And if it's okay with you, Representative Norton, I'm going to ask Ms. Pugnelli if you can kind of, can you kind of give us the landscape on this a little bit? That would be helpful. Ms. Pugnelli, House Research.
Madam Chair and members, there are kind of two pieces to what the department needed to do for the federal compliance. There's the rate setting methodology that is in the two bills that we're discussing right now, and then there's also provider standards. The provider standards were actually passed in a bill last year, and that is a new Chapter 245D that was mentioned. Changes to that chapter of law are included in the governor's bill this year, so that's in House File 1233. And the licensing fees that people have mentioned are also in the governor's bill this year, and I think that's in Chapter 245A.
Thank you, Ms. Pugnelli. Representative Grunhagen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So basically the concern about 245D isn't in 1448. That's what you're saying. If I understand that correctly.
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, that's correct. 245D has already been enacted into law. That was done last year, so it's not a part of this bill. There are some changes to 245D that are in the governor's bill, but not in either one of these bills that we're discussing this morning.
Okay, Representative Norton.
And Madam Chair, I think we'd like Ms. Bartolik to address that because it is addressed in the payment methodology, so there is a link between the two, and perhaps she can talk about that.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, part of the issue when we were working with CMS is that there are different types of service arrangements, and some are done by families which have people live in their homes and they provide the care. There are versions also where they hire staff and bring it in. And so as we were looking at some of the standards, what we were finding is that many family foster care providers were having similar expectations that we would of any provider for the service, and we had to look at the standards across that. In 1448, this bill, we do include in the service area around residential services, the methodology does include components to compensate all providers, whether they're family foster care or corporate foster care, for some of the expenses of running a business. We do recognize there will be expenses, and so some of the family foster care providers that have been paid fairly low will actually see some increases in what their rates will be. So we did try to accommodate the fact that there were some standards and some things they would have to do in that. And I just also wanted to address, why did we look at deafness? Last year, we actually had a number of customizations where we were going to vary the rate based on certain conditions and trying to acknowledge providers' training. And our stakeholders, actually, in working with them, said, you know, we all have to do training, and we all specialize, and we all have to kind of have focus areas. And they wanted to see the money we had dedicated for this put back into the methodology so that the rates and the wages overall could be higher. The one difference we found is that if you have to hire staff who are fluent signers and sign language because people are deaf and hard of hearing, that was a market niche that we did put a small increase because of that. But we did research it quite a bit in making that decision.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bartolik, for clarifying that. Representative Grunhagen, something else?
Yeah, just real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm understanding this right, the testimony that was given of the concerns said these corporate requirements are being forced down onto family foster care, and they gave an estimate that there's the potential of 500 going out of business. But does the governor address that at all in terms of, or is this a maintenance of effort from the federal government that is being forced onto the family foster care?
Ms. Bartolik?
Madam Chair, we have to have consistent standards. And so in 245D, there's actually different levels. There's almost tiers, is a way of looking at it, of what kinds of qualifications and programming staff need to do. I mean, we'd be happy to talk with the people who testified, others of their association. We have had some members on our advisory committee. We know where there's some areas that we have to keep working through. The other issue here is we're trying to figure out, we want to compensate the cost fairly, and the rate methodology does include some of those additional costs.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is really an important thing, and especially whenever you do it budget neutral, you have winners and losers, and I must say, as a decision maker, I'm really disappointed that we don't have any background material provided to us on any of the analysis that I'm sure if you've been working on this for 2 years, you have, to let us know who's impacted up, who's impacted down, what are the ranges. We understand in the bill that you can't go up more or down more than 1% a year, but how is someone who might be looking at, I don't know if it's ultimately a 10% a year drop, and so they're going to have a 1% drop in reimbursement for the next 10 years. What does that mean in terms of their viability? I mean, I just feel like we're being asked to do some really big changes that I don't have a sense of scale on. And so I hope that before this goes to the Finance Committee, we can really get some good summary analysis and information to understand what we're dealing with. Because once it gets into place, we know we're going to hear about how it impacts particular providers in our area. And I think before we act on it, we ought to really understand that. So I'd like to know kind of like what is the range, the maximum high and low, and what is yet to be done before implementation. I think there was comments made about looking at geographic differences and some other factors that you still wanted to look at. And will those need legislative authorization, or that's something you're going to bring back to us next year and we'll start down the road before we can get to kind of all the levels that you'd like to look at?
And before you answer that, Representative Mack wanted to make a comment to that point.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative Loeffler's point, so I don't have to waste too much time of the testifier's time, but I've had the chance to sit down with folks from the department and meet with some of the folks in my district on this issue and the concerns. And I understand the thousands of hours that have been put into this, and it's been, as the chair has said, a painstaking process. You know, at the same time, we had discussions on the floor the other day about the timing of this bill coming forward and everything. And I guess, in addition to some of Representative Loeffler's concerns in terms of just some of the background data that we have in front of us, and this is obviously controversial, will have a huge impact going forward. I guess I would hope to just wanted to add to Representative Loeffler is asking for, and also maybe just to Ms. Bartolik, if you could just shed some light in terms of the process and the timing in which, you know, the legislature had the chance to get this and hear this as close as we are to deadlines and everything else. If you could just shed some light so we have a better understanding of that, that would be helpful.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, I'll answer the last part, and then I'll go back. This was about the process and why did it come in later? Is that the question? And we had, last year, the legislature gave us some timelines, and we had until February 15th to work with our stakeholders before we presented information. And so it just, when you look at the bill process of getting something through, it was a late start to have until February 15th. And we did work until that with stakeholders to try to massage as much of the language and the issues as we could. So we're sorry that it did get caught up in the process, but that was part of it. It wasn't something we had prepared at the typical time of our other bills. And Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, we'll be happy to share the analysis that we've done and the different simulations that we've done. I think it was a question of how much detail do we provide to you. It is true that there is a level of detail about, for any one provider, what is that impact going to mean that we do not have. But we do have a lot of the simulations, a lot of the information that was used to inform the process.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, do we have, like, a maximum high or low? Can you tell us sort of the range, even if you can't get it down to providers, that you expect providers will have to adjust to, that you don't see anyone getting more than 5% more, 5% less, or 10% more, 10% less? Do you have any kind of range for us?
In our term of art, I think Representative Loeffler is asking for the runs on the bill.
Madam Chair, we know that the rates are so variable right now. So again, remember, there's part of the problem was that we have a range of rates for very similar services that are very extreme. We will look at the information. I don't know that I can tell you right now what's the most impact and the least impact. Some of the impact we have tried to manage by doing these service bucket neutrality factors. So as Lynn Noren was saying, you know, some of the providers, it looked like it was quite a variation, and so we would be applying a budget neutrality factor to keep it from going to that point. But we will look at information, and I can't give you more specifics right now.
And Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, the other thing that I have a concern about is that we're setting salaries in law, or at least using factors that are dollars per hour, which I can see in future years I can see lots of bills with changing these numbers, as opposed to units that, you know, could vary. And so you could say a supervisory unit is, you know, 1.3 of a direct service or something like that. But if you look on page 818, we have, you know, sleeping is $766 per hour, unless, of course, it's family foster, and then it's only $280 an hour. Well, it's, if it's the same service, I think it actually we ought to look at about the same. But then we have basic wage for supervisory staff is $17.43 an hour. If a supervisor's earning $16, does that mean that we're going to go to a uniform wage, or is it just a formula factor? I'm just trying to understand, but I really feel like I'd be more comfortable with a unit approach than actual pennies, because I can see us legislatively being challenged to add, is it 23 cents or 33 cents to the factor? And we may be tempted in the future to get whatever balance you've worked out of alignment, because one group or another will be coming to us asking to change their number and statute.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, this has been actually one of the main issues we've been dealing with for several years. We're trying to build a prospective rate that has values that are reasonable estimates of on an average to put in. It does not obligate that rate to be what's there. There's things about benefits. Some providers offer benefits. There might be differences if they're part-time, full-time. We looked and took the recommendations from an intensive work group of stakeholders, their recommendations using labor statistics of what are average wages for different job classes. And so actually the legislation does show you what they came up with for the job classes. This is just to start building, in the end, a payment rate. Providers have flexibility within that of how they apply it. It does not obligate a particular wage. It doesn't say that's what it should be. And by using the labor statistics, it's less of the unit of service, and it would be more of looking over future years. Did the value associated with that go up or down when people are looking at changing? Part of the negotiations that have gone on and very intensive work is the stakeholders want to know what are the factors that are building the rate. They didn't want to just see a grouping, because as their costs change, they want to go back and understand the different components of it. So this was a deliberate decision to try to use the best information to build the components of a rate that's reasonable, but it does not require a provider to pay certain things or do certain things. It was just a way of putting it together. And wherever we could, we tried to use Minnesota data that we can go back. The legislature could say, oh, yes, here's a frame of reference to understand if these costs have gone up and down, or information from providers themselves.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That helps explain how you got here. And I know you had a short time frame to do something very, very complicated. But we're all just trying to understand kind of what the future is. The last thing I would say is I think I just really think we need to have a discussion about the role of family foster care in the now and in the future. And some states are really promoting this. I think for stability and continuity of care, it's a preferred model for many, versus corporate staff, a shift staff with high turnover. And just because we've in the past been able to financially discriminate between these two providers of services, I don't know that that's the policy choice we should make going forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I'm not seeing any other questions. And members, I just want to remind you and remind the audience that this bill is, hopefully we can pass it out of this committee, send it to finance, where Representative Huntley has possession already of 1586. So these two bills will be heard together in finance. I know Representative Norton is going to continue to work with everybody on this, and Ms. Bartolik is going to continue to work with the stakeholders, and we hope that we'll be able to pass from the Finance Committee something that is reasonably workable for everybody. So with that, members, without, if there are no further discussion on this bill, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1448 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed to the Finance Committee. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda, we're going to take up Representative Norton's other bill, which is 1064. And then, I think everybody in the room probably has the agenda, and at this time we are planning to follow the order that's on that, so you can get a sense of when your bill will be heard. And audience, if you're leaving the room, please be quiet because we are continuing with our hearing. And the chair will move House File 1064. I will move that 1064 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Norton.
I didn't go very far, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for hearing House File 1064. This bill just has a direct appropriation of $170,000 in fiscal year 2014. Health disparities. There are fiscal disparities in the state as well, but that's a whole other issue. What we're trying to do is address some disparities in women's reproductive health among the Somali community, and we know there are issues with this. We have Fartoon Welly here, who's going to talk a little bit about the work that she's done and what she has discovered in her research, and she has some thoughts and ideas about how we might reach out to this community and provide better health care in the area of women's reproductive health and close the disparities and the gaps that we have in treatment and what will have long-term financial impact on the state in a positive way. So we'll let her just talk for a minute about her research.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fartoon Welly, and I am the founder and the executive director of a community-led organization called Isuron. Isuron, Somali word, means self-empowered women. So that is why we chose our organization's name. I want to say on behalf of Isuron members and supporters, I want to thank the community for giving our bill a chance to say something about why this bill is so important. I myself am a public health professional, and I'm greatly concerned about the health inequality of our community or our community of color. Just to be specific, our 2010 census shows that 86% of Somali immigrants, especially women, speak little or no English, and 76% of Somali women live under the poverty rate level. They all show, even though we're a brand new community, they all show the socioeconomic factors, that the health issues that cause socioeconomic factors. What we know as a public health professional or community worker is that our state has no plan to address the health inequality because we're a brand new community. We don't fit the norm of health, how the healthcare system is delivered. And to address our needs, we have to have our own blueprint to be culturally specific. And that work has to come within the community. No one else can develop that, because we have to develop our own blueprint. And our organization, Isuron, with the support of our community, had decided to focus that need and to address that grassroots work and how we can identify how we learn, what are our obstacles, how we can establish partners that we can partner that can help us grow. But everything else is the concept is do for yourself. We have to come up with our own way of addressing our healthcare needs. So we have done a couple research, and we found out that even though Somali community immigrants are brand new, we have the highest rate of heart disease, obesity, diabetes, postpartum depression, and everything else that there is there that African Americans and Hispanics and other minorities suffer. As a community leader and a public health professional, what my job is to identify, if we were to discover a blueprint for Somali community, what does that mean? How do you even start that? And what we found out is a process called MAP. It's a community mobilizing through action and partnership. It has process that you follow A to Z, where you can trace back and evaluate again. And that's what we've discovered. CDC approves it. Other counties and other cities use it. Unfortunately, our state does not use it. So we're trying to, as a community-led organization, to do that for our own community. The challenge of getting funded has been very difficult as well, because what we're trying does not fit the norm, again, as I would say. It's not, there are no lot of fundings out there that address these, that fund this kind of a concept or initiative. And it is, what we're doing is towards prevention. And we have not seen a lot of funding about prevention. So in conclusion, my hope is that our community decided to take a leadership role and toward creating opportunities to address our healthcare needs and get out of poverty and have a better future. And we're hoping that you support this bill and this initiative that helps Somali women and their families for better future and better prosperity. Thank you.
And Madam Chair? Representative Norton.
Just to highlight the work that she's done, the research that she's done, her objectives are to detect breast and cervical cancer earlier, identify new cases of HIV, reduce the frequency of sex and the number of partners, the risk factors related to teen pregnancies, and I believe there's a component on cervical, I said that breast and cervical cancer. So there are issues that we know are of concern to the general population, but Fartoon's research shows that there may be a different approach needing to be taken within the Somali community in order to get them to those services. And so that's what she's hoping to do with the grant.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for members? Well, first of all, I should ask, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing anybody. Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton and Madam, is there any, I see there's a metropolitan-based approach. Is there any idea to serve the growing population of Somali folks in southern Minnesota?
Ms. Welly.
What I wanted to say is to amend that this the method that we're trying to develop Somali community is so small that it's for every Somali community. It's included Rochester, St. Cloud, South. We're a very tiny community, so the method that we will develop is going to be used by all Somali community, and we're hoping that our state is going to be the first one that does that, so even our other states can use, so that, yes, they will be part of this program as well.
So, Madam Chair, could we just do an oral amendment on line 1.8 and take out the term metropolitan area and just put Minnesota?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, on line 1.7, strike the and metropolitan area and insert the word Minnesota.
So I'm going to move an oral amendment to the bill on line 1.7 at the end of the line to strike the word the, on 1.8 to strike the words metropolitan area and insert Minnesota.
Thank you.
Okay. Everybody got that? So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Further questions from members? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question for the author. I'm just wondering, is there a Somali-based organization, or how would these dollars flow? I guess reading through the bill, I don't see anything real conclusive on how this would get to the communities and how that's measured and everything else. If you could just maybe shed a little light on if there are groups out there who are set up and ready to accept money like this that can get it out to the people as quickly as possible who are needing these services.
Representative Norton.
Yes, it does address that the commissioner will disperse the funds on it, and it does refer to that, and the commissioner will submit a report. I have actually talked to the department, Jim Koppel, Assistant Commissioner Koppel, about this, and he's willing to talk further about how that might be implemented. Or Fartoon has an organization that would be willing to do that, but I think the department would like to follow kind of the RFP process that they currently use for other grants and fiscal disbursements. So we'll work with him further on that.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one follow-up. To the testifier, I know you had talked about, maybe you could expound, or maybe the author, too, could shed some light on this from your work. Just wondering, you talk about needing to create your own blueprint, and I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, in the materials that are going to be provided or educational materials, is the thought that there's stuff out there that are working in other communities, whether it's ethnic communities or whatever the case might be, that would just be replicated into the Somali language and dispersed? Or are we talking materials that need to explain some of these concepts, you know, in a whole new way? I guess I'm trying to understand, what does it mean to create a whole new blueprint for, and then if that's the case, we're talking one sector of society, and it's certainly a worthy project for public health reasons, but I guess I'm just wondering, secting this one area out when there's probably needs in a lot of different areas, and why we're picking this if we're talking about creating a whole new way of delivering information. So if you could just shed some light on that.
Ms. Welly.
Yeah, so the reason, so the blueprint, when I'm saying blueprint, means that the Somali community, because now when we're addressing health education, say we're addressing teen pregnancy. When you talk about sexual issues, my community, I grew up being told you cannot have sex, period. And we follow that. We have new generation here. Like I have, if I had a kid or a kid, I'd never grow up discussing about sexual health and protection and condom and all that. We have new generation that came here that has American kids who are cultured over here, but we have parents who are not. To even have see a pediatrician and talk about teen pregnancy and teen sex, it's unheard of. That's creating a huge wage between the healthcare providers and our community. So the blueprint is sitting down with the community members, like we're doing now. One of our projects that Department of Health is funding it is to find out how do we pass by this idea of, hey, you cannot have sex, period. We're saying we've been changed, you know, we're moved into new country, kids are different. How do we value still our own values and our culture, but learn to educate our kids, because we have the highest chlamydia rate in our community now. We have pregnancies that we've never had. So the blueprint means sitting down with our own communities, and we come up with a way of having a conversation with our own community, and then coming, deciding that we have to move in and into this new culture without jeopardizing our own values. So who could do that conversation we can do that conversation. We, as a community, as health educators, we can do that. If a Western person comes in and talks about that, there will be a cultural barrier. There will be conversation that will not go anywhere. So the blueprint means having a cultural specific questions with the community and getting answers from them that they can accept. So what's happening now is that there are no conversation like that. All the intervention programs about sexual health are being designed and evaluated for our general population. And to address the health inequality or to reduce this kind of issues, you have to have an ethnic group, specifically agenda, and a conversation and get that answer and then use with the public health methodology to address these kind of questions.
Yeah. And Madam Chair?
Representative Norton?
I have quite a comprehensive research project that Fortuna has done. The research is here for anyone interested in doing it, and she did discuss this MAP process, which is not necessarily new, but new to Minnesota and has worked in other places. And that's so it's not recreating something. It's using something that has worked here in our state.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Mack? Okay. Pardon? Oh, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. You just referenced that the context of the work that you've already accomplished has, I'm sure, shed a great deal of light on the issues that affect that community. And you also testified to the fact that you are having conversations within the generations. And I'm trying to be mindful of the generations and the ideology here, but I'm questioning. It seems to me like you're already having those conversations. Why would you need this type of program to continue that conversation if you know the issue and you know the means by which to have the conversation? It seems like you're placing a burden on the state to facilitate that when you have the most intimate understanding about what issues are facing your generations, and but yet it seems like you're putting someone in the middle of it that might postpone the efficacy of the work you've already done.
So,
Ms. Welly.
Oh, sorry, God. Me. That's a good question, and we have been doing this grassroots for 3 years. It's time. So the work we've been doing, we've never registered it. We've never used the public health methodology in terms of writing and documenting and evaluating the conversations we had. How is that changing the community's minds, or how is that contributing to the goal of eliminating health disparity? With this fund, what it will do, it will take us to a process to document, reassess, evaluate, and see how is this working and how that relates to what this also funding is going to do with the process that we're going to use that other states use. Is also will identify partners, will identify people that we can collaborate that is beyond our health department, health and human services. It will create collaborative. It will create more ways to develop health education that are specific to whether this minority community, other minority communities can also replicate. So what we're trying to do here is to start something that every community can use, but it never been funded. All we're doing is using our own resources, individual community resources, and we have nothing to show for, to document. This fund is going to take to the next level, which is where we need to be in order for us to even have anything that's documented and that we can report you to.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up then with regard to the health care providers themselves, and I think of some of the larger entities that probably have, as part of their mandate, care and concern for all ethnic groups and a means of reaching out to them pertinent to the issues that they face, as well as the AMA as part of their desire to be able to address the issues regardless of who presents themselves for medical care. I'm just wondering if those two groups have weighed in on some of the issues that you've expressed, if you've expressed to them these issues to them, and if you've gotten any kind of response from them and how they are going about addressing these same issues. I'm sure Mayo, with Representative Norton at the testifier's table, is intimately aware of some of these issues, and I'm just wondering how Mayo would address these as well.
Ms. Welly, did you, or Representative Norton?
To the healthcare providers, I worked for a healthcare provider for 13 years. So physicians see patients who do they not understand how to interact with them. So what's happening is that if you look at the data about, you get legislative reports about health disparity every year, if you see it, the 15 minutes that the physician is seeing this patient does not translate having a better service or better care. It's beyond the communication, how the health education is delivered. This does not only address disease versus, hey, take this insulin because you have a diabetes. What we're addressing is how do you even create better communication with a patient who had never dealt with or never had an opportunity to go to a physician and use a prevention idea. The prevention idea is brand new concept to our own community, as some other immigrants as well. So the physicians, our physicians, see patients who are way into a chronic disease, and they don't know how to handle it. Because if you say, if I tell our group, go do a breast exam, they won't. They will say, I'm not going to go and do breast, and why do I need to bother and find problems? What we're trying to address is to find all these barriers that prevent a patient or a community member to see the physician from the first place and prevent having a chronic diseases that will cause the state a lot and also cause our community a lot of issues and a lot of unproductive activities. So about the MA and the health and physicians, I'm sure they will say we have a high health disparities, but I don't know how that is going to benefit to our own community, because we are the ones who are looking at the data every year and seeing that we have our health disparity is growing and nothing's been addressed. We're trying to take an initiative, active initiative, and taking ownership to address our own needs. So we're hoping that what we're doing is also making it easier for healthcare providers to understand our own needs and to have a better relationship with the patients as well.
Representative Shawn. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Moran is on the list first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Norton for bringing this legislation to this committee, and also Fontoon for stepping up to really support and advocate for the Somali community, which is not an easy thing for a Somali woman to do. So I just want to thank you for taking those steps to do that. And I just want to, and not that I'm so informed and knowledgeable about the Somali community, but, you know, not only in the Somali community, but I think in communities of color in general, so often our work is twofold, you know, and one of that is that, you know, we are constantly advocating and educating and informing our own community about the strengths and how we can, you know, work towards better health, or whatever that needs be, may be. And the second part of our work is always to inform others' communities, to educate and inform them around the issues that are impacting our community in a more informed way so we can make better decisions that really support all of us, you know, in a healthy way. So it's always twofold. It's not always about educating our community. It's about educating others, too, so they can be more informed. Because there are crises that goes on within our community that we need to highlight, you know, not only for ourselves but also for others, so that we can get the resources and have the tools to be better advocates, you know, for a stronger community and a stronger state and a stronger world. So, again, I don't have a question. I just want to make that statement that the challenge that you face is a challenge that many communities of color faces in order to create better outcomes for our families and our community. So, again, just want to thank you and Representative Norton for coming forth with this type of legislation, because it's needed.
Thank you, Representative Brand. Representative Shawn.
Madam Chair, and Representative Norton, and Miss, is it Fartoon? And I apologize if I say that wrong.
No, you said it right.
Okay. What is it? You know, I gotta say it's refreshing to hear the balance between culture and reality. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely respect you for having the courage to come up here and sit here and say that the reality of this situation is we do have what we believe and what our communities will tell us no matter where we're from, and that the reality is that times are changing.
Yep.
And 20 years ago or 25 years ago or however long it was, we would hide pregnant girls and send them off to Aunt Sally's in Chicago. And we wouldn't acknowledge gays. We wouldn't acknowledge people for being human beings because of whatever may happen. But those things happened then and they happen now. And we're better off. We talk about traditional family values and all sorts of different things. Well, those are different things to different people. But healthcare is the same across the board. And acknowledging that no matter what community you're in, that it's important to address that, this is fantastic. And I know it's hard for you. From my background of working with various communities, I'm really excited to hear the things that you're saying today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you for your testimony and the work you've done and the concern. I know it's a critical issue as far as the health is concerned. I just make a suggestion. I would especially use materials that promote abstinence until marriage to your young people, especially the young men. Okay, they probably need it more than anybody else, the way it sounds. And I would stay away from materials that reflect the fraudulent research of Dr. Alfred Kinsey. Okay? Kinsey was a liar and a fraud, and so was his research. Unfortunately, his philosophy has permeated our colleges and public school system of this country. It's done nothing but create health problems and heartache and disappointment. Just a suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions. Representative Norton, do you want to say a final word on this, and then we'll take a vote on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for a good discussion. This is an important topic, not just for the Somali community, which we're highlighting today, but for all communities across our state. And I'm thrilled that we're addressing disparities this way this morning, and I appreciate your time at the table.
Thank you, Representative Norton. And actually, having said that you could get the final word, I probably shouldn't take the final word, but I'm going to because I should have done it before that. But I just also wanted to express my appreciation to Ms. Welly for the work that she's doing, and that we've had. This is really an important discussion, and I think it's certainly important for the Somali community, but it's important because we have a lot of minority communities with different kinds of health needs, and we know that disparities among different groups that's a huge problem in our state. And yet we know that as more of us in the state are from a minority community, and we need everybody in the state to be healthy and working at the top of their game, so to speak. We can't afford to lose minority or subgroups of our population to issues that we can help with and make sure that people are productive and as successful as they can be. So this is one small piece of that, so I really appreciate your coming forward with that. So with that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1064 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Loeffler, House File 1039.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I'd like to move that House File 1039 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and I do have an A1 amendment that I think needs to be distributed.
All right. Representative Loeffler moves that House File 1039 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And so that amendment is going to be distributed, I think. So, Representative Loeffler, maybe you'd like to just start talking.
I'd be glad to give you the context on this. And members also This tries to address a number of issues related to MA eligibility for seniors and persons with disabilities. And we've spent a lot of time this session earlier dealing with how to take advantage of opportunities to expand coverage under medical assistance for persons without disabilities because of the MA expansion and the opportunities that are provided under the Affordable Care Act to cover more people with that. And but you'll see from a table in your packet that we still have some ways to go with the elderly and disabled because they're still, in current law, held at 100% of poverty in terms of basic eligibility, or if they spend down, they have to spend down to an income level of 75% of the poverty federal poverty level, which for a single person is only $8,400 a year. And at 75% of poverty, or $11,170 for 100% of federal poverty. What this bill would do when we adopt the amendment is provide for a three-year phase-in to the 133% of federal poverty levels as calculated by MAJE for these populations with 5% the first year and then 10% and 10%. So it's a phase-in. Was seeking federal authority, of course, to do that. And it also addresses an issue that has been a concern of mine, which is that we have not increased the asset levels for these categories of eligibility for a long period of time. It stayed at $3,000 for an individual. We know that that's a huge worry source for people who are living in their own home particularly. $3,000 in home repairs isn't hard to come by at any time, and it's hard for some of our elderly, frail people to stay, and people with disabilities to stay in their homes with so limited assets. And the value of that $3,000 for all people who live in the community has certainly diminished over time. And the final item addresses the issue of a married couple where one of them is has a disability, is on one of the waiver programs, and how we would not take their asset income into account, because oftentimes this is a spouse who also is under 65, still working and needing to save for their own retirement and a cost, health care costs in the long term. And with that, I'd like to have Ann Henry share a little bit more information. I have to say publicly I really appreciate her work in assisting with this and helping us fine-tune some of the pieces.
And before we go to Ms. Henry, Representative Loeffler, we've got the A1 now, so if you would move that, we could maybe we could get that on the bill, and then we'll be
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the H-1039 A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. We represent children and adults across Minnesota with a variety of disabilities, mental illness, intellectual and developmental disability, brain injury, physical disabilities. And I would really like to express our appreciation to Representative Loeffler for being willing to take this on and try to be sure everybody understands what the issues are here. Just by way of background to get everybody's mind on medical assistance, known federally as Medicaid, it's important to understand that you have to have no more than a certain amount of income and no more than a certain amount of savings in order to qualify. And in health reform, that's what the chart is so important to show, we raised the bottom for everybody else on Medicaid. But people with disabilities and seniors are left for the states to deal with wherever the state had them. And that's what we call work undone. It's a task on our to-do list, and that's what this bill is about. The place that we are right now really leaves people in a difficult situation because our policy, our state policy, is to encourage people to live independently in the community, even with disabilities or as seniors, and that's where people want to be. And so they're renting in the same markets, buying in the same grocery stores, yet they are allowed to have less
money on a monthly basis. And what this really amounts to, especially that spend down to the 75th tier of the poverty level, that's $699 a month. It means that people that get a Social Security check have to spend everything they get down to $699 to access health care. It's a huge deductible or coinsurance every month. So to be sure you understand what the bill does now as amended, it doesn't take us all the way that we need to go, which is up to 138, where the bottom is for everybody else on Medicaid now. But it does take a big and important step, which is to raise that 75% spend down level over 3 years, beginning the second year of the biennium. And that would be a very important step to take. It would mean that everybody in the elderly disabled group would be at 100% of the poverty level. We have more to do, but that is a big step. Section 3, to just reiterate, only requires the department to convene and make recommendations about changing the asset level. And the reason that we've taken this approach is because we have a complexity in that group, because some people are in group homes and nursing facilities, and their room and board is taken care of. But again, our state policy is to encourage, and we have a lot of people in the community, those folks need to have savings to maintain themselves. And the final issue is to keep doing what Minnesota's doing for married couples under 65, which allows families who have a disabled spouse to keep going. Minnesota is doing this. Unfortunately, in the Affordable Care Act, they corrected a lot of other states and imposed what we do for seniors called the spousal impoverishment protections, but that really was designed for people over 65 who are retired and had savings, and it doesn't recognize the employed spouse. So this requires DHS to ask federal authority to keep doing what we're doing now for the under 65 married couple. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry, and I just want to say that, you know, we've very much appreciate your role in educating this committee on these very often complex, difficult issues, and you always do a very good job of making them understandable for us. Members, are there any questions? My list is left over from the last bill. So, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you to the testifier. When we expanded Medicaid under the ACA, which my understanding this has some type of connection to that, but there are a couple things. Is there a federal match with this increase also?
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes. People who are eligible now for Medicaid, we get the federal match, and that would be the same if we raise the income standard. States are free to raise the income standard, and so we would continue to get the match that we do now, which is 50-50.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So what is the – I don't see a fiscal note with this.
Representative Grunhagen, this is going to the Finance Committee, and that part of the point here, I think, is that we will be able to get a fiscal note as we move along.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Then I'll probably wait on my question till the I ask this quick question, if I could, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
You know, one of the things that really concerned me about the previous expansion that we dealt with, I think it was about 170,000 people, is that there weren't asset or residency requirements in terms of the expansion. And the way I read this, there is some, it raises the asset limit. Is there residency requirements as far as being a resident of the state of Minnesota? You know, under the previous one, it was, I intend to live in the state. That was the gray requirement, which to me is a little flimsy, but you know, could you respond to that question?
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, the residency requirements remain as they are today. We're not dealing with that in any way, and we do have a policy of people declaring where they live, and that's their residence.
So, and Representative Grunhagen, and I'm sorry, there are other testifiers as well, so why don't, maybe we should hear from them, and then I'm sure more questions will probably be generated.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Toby Pearson? Okay, I'm not seeing Toby Pearson. Carrie Sheldon? Oh, there's Toby Pearson. I'm sorry. Come on in. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, they actually put our name down for the wrong bill.
Oh.
Testifying on the Atkins bill. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just ask then if there's... Okay, we have a testifier. And welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Sheldon. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I live on my own in an apartment in St. Paul. I'm active with ADAPT Minnesota, a disability rights group. I'm also a part of the You Be the Change program at Community Action Programs, where I work on issues pertaining to people with low income. I am also an active member of Act for Equity, where we deal with issues pertaining to the city. I count on my medical assistance to stay healthy and get the personal care assistance services I need to live my life and be a part of my community. Right now, I receive $1,145 per month in Social Security disability, but I don't get to keep that money. I'm forced to spend down $426 of my limited income to pay for my health care and PCE services through medical assistance. This means that I must live on $719 a month. That's $719 for rent, phone, electricity, personal items, metro mobility fares, food, and anything else I might need. I am fortunate to have found a place to live in a Section 8 building where my rent is based off of my income. But without that, I wouldn't be able to afford a place to live. I'm worried about my future because the building where I am living right now is going to be renovated. The paints and chemicals that they will be using are not healthy for me, so I need to find somewhere else to live temporarily. I don't know how I'm going to find anything I can afford. Like many people with disabilities, I've been working for years to find a good competitive job. The unemployment rate for people with disabilities is 12.3%, and the unemployment rate for people without disabilities is 7.9%. I really want to work. If I could find a job, I could be on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, and I wouldn't have to be forced to give up so much of my income for health care. I hope my problem would be solved when more people are able to get MA in 2014 through the Affordable Care Act. Instead, I learned that someone with my same amount of income, which is under 138% of the poverty level, who does not have a disability and Social Security, will be able to get MA without paying anything, but I will still be forced to pay $426 because I have a disability. I feel insulted that I am expected to live on even less than other people just because I am a person with a disability who is having a hard time finding a job. This is something you have the power to fix. People, please do what is fair and vote for this bill so that me and other people with disabilities are able to access MA without being forced to live on deeper poverty than those without disabilities. I only have 20 years until retirement, and I want the chance to retire with dignity and respect. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sheldon. Appreciate having you come down today. We have other testifiers, I think. I have Mary Jo George on the list, but please come on up, and then we'll have an opportunity if there are other people who want to speak for or against the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. We very strongly support this legislation to raise the income standards for people with disabilities and with seniors. We'd like to thank Representative Loeffler for bringing this forward. Next year, beginning in 2014, we are going to see some major changes with our nursing home level of care criteria. Stricter criteria will be implemented, and as a result of that, we're going to see many seniors having now to spend down to 75% of poverty to retain Medicaid income eligibility. And that's because our elderly waiver program allowed people to continue on the program at the poverty level. And our concern is that if we don't bring this income standard up, many seniors may not have the resources to continue living independently in the community. And I think the worst thing that we would do is if people spiral down and end up not falling through the cracks and needing nursing home care, we've really defeated the purpose and goals of our desire to have people with lower needs on different programs. So we'd like to echo what Ann Henry said, that with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, with the expansion of Medicaid to 138%, it makes sense with this bill that we continue with the promise of federal reform to bring the income standards up for other groups, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. George. And are there others who'd like to, anyone else who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Loeffler, I am not seeing anybody, so are there questions from members? Okay, and I just want to comment that Representative Loeffler, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward for us to think about. The Affordable Care Act is doing a lot of great things, but it's not fixing all problems, and of course when you have a huge change, you're going to have some unexpected or unanticipated consequences, and so I appreciate this coming forward so that we can all kind of understand some of the pieces that need to be brought along here and things we need to consider. And final word goes to you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I think this is just a matter of us keeping up to the changes in service delivery. And Minnesota has always been a leader in helping people live independently in the community, in their own homes or apartments. And I think a lot of our federal law reflects that other states are behind us. They're still putting people into institutional care, which works for some people, but should be the last option if people can stay in their own homes, can stay in their communities with some supports. And so this is an opportunity for us to step up and catch our statutes and our policies to reflect that, because we have been a leader, and I hope we'll continue to be a leader in supporting people staying where they want to stay, in their own homes, in their community, maximizing their independence, and having enough resources to actually meet their basic needs and live a decent life.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 1039 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1136, and that's my bill, and Representative Moran is going to take the gavel.
Hello, Representative Liebling. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1136 be recommended to pass and go to, I believe this is going to the General Register. Am I correct there?
It is.
Thank you. To the General Register.
Okay, Representative Levin moves House File 1136 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then before we get started, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment, which is being handed out. And if we could adopt this, we'll have a lot of description of what the bill does with the amendment on it. And this is basically the result of quite a bit of work among the stakeholders, which you will hear about as we discuss the bill. So if we could adopt that DE2 amendment, I would appreciate it.
All those in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment, say aye.
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 Any opposed? So moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, the bill that's before you is basically from the Board of Pharmacy, and the initial one of the real moving factors behind this bill is I'm sure that many of you heard about the problem that we had in the state and across the country with fungal meningitis, which was a result of some problems in the pharmaceutical chain. And Cody Weiberg, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, has here an attempt to begin dealing with that problem so that we can make sure that pharmaceutical products in the state of Minnesota are properly processed so that we don't have the kind of contamination problem that occurred in this very sad instance in which we had, I don't know how many deaths, he probably knows, but this was quite a serious incident that occurred recently. And so I felt that it was very important that we move forward with these changes. Since we're in session, we have the opportunity to do this. We can possibly prevent another health crisis from occurring. And there's been a lot of discussion around this bill. This is a very complicated area. I in no way pretend to understand all the ins and outs of it. So we are relying here heavily on a lot of our experts and working between the stakeholders. So we've had a number of stakeholders working with Mr. Weiberg on this bill, and I want to, at the outset, express my appreciation to all of the parties who, believe me, this has been quite a sprint to get this in shape here at today with some consensus among all of the stakeholders about what we can do right now to address the immediate problem. There may be some things that we'll want to do later on. This I don't think we're trying to solve all problems in this bill, but we definitely need to address the immediate safety issues that are facing our state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Weiberg and let him describe for you what the bill is doing, and we'll all get a little education here this morning, I'm sure. So,
thank good morning, you, Mr. Weiberg.
Weiberg.
Yes,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, which is a state agency that has responsibility not only for regulating the practice of pharmacy within the state, but also the distribution and manufacture and wholesaling of drugs within the state and from outside of the state. As Representative Liebling has already mentioned, this bill is an attempt to deal with a very serious issue that occurred. In fact, the New England Compounding Center Pharmacy, based out of Massachusetts, prepared close to 17,000 doses of a injectable product, shipped those doses to 23 different states, including Minnesota. It was contaminated with a fungus, which actually can live in the body as a spore for decades. So although at this point, out of those 17,000 potential infected people, there are 700 and some around the country that have been infected, 12 in Minnesota that have been infected, 50 that have died around the country, fortunately none in Minnesota. All of the other people who have been exposed to this product are not out of the woods yet, because that fungus at some point could flare up and cause an infection for them. That's why this particular crisis is being compared to the thalidomide disaster of the early 1960s that led to major changes at the federal level in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. This is a very, very significant issue. I'd like to say that the New England Compounding Center Pharmacy, which I'll refer to as NEC after all, or after this, NEC was actually already violating current state law as interpreted by the Board of Pharmacy, in that they were only licensed by us as a pharmacy. That means they should have only been shipping drugs into the state after they got a prescription for an individual patient. Instead, they were shipping large batches at wholesale, and they were acting as a manufacturer. They were not licensed as a manufacturer or a wholesaler, and they actually received warning letters from us because, although we couldn't prove it, we had some suspicion that they were doing exactly what they did, and they continued doing this as well. So with that description, what this bill does is strengthen the licensing provisions. What we have found out in this, as a result of this situation, is some of the assumptions that we made about how other states were licensing and regulating businesses like this, and even how the FDA was regulating in this area, were not correct. We assumed that the other states were doing the sort of job that we do. In Minnesota, no facility that we license, be it a pharmacy, wholesaler, manufacturer, medical gas distributor, we don't issue a license until we go out and inspect the facility, and then we do periodic, routine, unannounced inspections. Turns out in Massachusetts, they did the first part. They inspected pharmacies when they opened them, but they didn't go into them again unless they got a complaint. And so what this bill basically does is it would require there's very little change for pharmacies within the state, but it essentially takes the standards we have and applies them to any sort of facility that wants to ship into Minnesota. So before we will license any of these entities that ship into the state, if this bill passes, they're going to have to prove their license in the state they're located in. If they are a manufacturer and they're required to be licensed by the FDA, they'll have to be registered by the FDA. They'll be registered by the FDA. And crucially, they're going to have to submit an inspection report that's no older than 24 months that meets the board's standards. We will be reviewing those reports, and if there's anything significant at all in those reports, the facility is going to have to provide evidence satisfactory to the board that they've corrected the deficiency before we'll license them. If they cannot get an inspection, there are some states we're finding out that don't do inspections at all. Our neighboring state, Wisconsin, apparently inspects no facilities ever. Then they're going to have to agree to be licensed by an agent of the board. Right now we are entering into talks with the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, which is currently doing these sort of inspections on behalf of the state of Iowa. So that's basically what this bill does. It also, the board already has rulemaking authority in a broad area, but this specifically directs the board to engage in rulemaking to determine the standards for licensure when a facility that wants to ship in the state is not required to be licensed in the other state or by the FDA. So this is the a step to deal with the most immediate pressing issue. As Representative Liebling mentioned, there will be other things that we will want to come back to next year after Congress has had a chance to work on this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Weiber, for that overview of the bill. Is there any questions from any of the members? Is there...
Madam Chair?
Mr. Representative Wurzlaw.
We'll go with that. Question for probably not the author. I'm sorry. I missed your name from the Board of Pharmacy. I apologize.
It's Cody Weiberg.
Mr. Weiberg. We're looking at the issue that you referenced is out of the compounding facility in Massachusetts, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, this was a facility that was licensed by as a compounding pharmacy, held itself out as a compounding pharmacy, but was actually acting more like a manufacturer. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. A couple follow-ups.
Representative Ross.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern, and I think clearly there's room for improvement, and obviously what occurred and how that affected multiple states is very concerning. My concern is around drug shortage and the drug shortage that's impacting, certainly when you look at anesthesia providers, and this was a injectable drug for pain management. My concern is throughout the anesthesia providers in this state, there already is a difficulty getting a lot of the drugs necessary. I'm concerned that such a broad licensure and inspection requirement will make drugs that are already very difficult to obtain even more so. And so I think just to hear some comments about that and kind of alleviate some of my fears around that, and then I have a question about one specific area of the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative, the board is very well aware of the drug shortage situation, and so is the Food and Drug Administration. I've been involved in a number of meetings directly with the Food and Drug Administration about this as well. It's one of several different issues that really link into the compounding issue. Nobody in the regulatory world, either the FDA or state boards of pharmacy, want to do anything to exacerbate the problem of drug shortages. In fact, what we're hoping, although it's going to take some time to settle the pieces here, we're hoping that this is actually going to improve the drug shortage situation because hospitals and other providers are going to be able to buy products that some of which right now the FDA would probably frankly say shouldn't be produced at all. We think the FDA is going to actually, as long as facilities are operating at better standards than they've been operating to in the past, is actually going to maybe allow a little bit more than they've wanted to allow at this point. We also think that the providers are going to be able to be more confident of the products that they buy. We're hearing right now that one of the issues here is many different providers, hospitals, they're reluctant and don't know who to buy from, which is causing more problems. We think that this will create clear standards, so there'll be confidence in that. This is a little bit unrelated. It's for next year. But the board will be bringing something forward next year to work on the drug shortage issue. One of the reasons we have drug shortages in the country is because of poor regulation of drug wholesaling. And there's a gray market out there. About the time that Congress started dealing with this, it issued a report on the gray market. That got no press because of the compounding thing. And I don't want to go into it here, but we're going to come back next year and work on that issue as well. There's a lot of inappropriate sales going on in this gray wholesaling market.
Representative Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiberg, I guess I'm wondering if you have any numbers or data to back that up as far as providers being concerned and not knowing where to purchase. I mean, from what I understand, the regional pain management and the injectable procedures haven't gone down since the concern with the outbreak. I talked to a lot of providers, and I haven't heard of anybody's calendars and schedules opening up. I know of three new pain clinics that have opened up in the last couple months around the metro area. So I don't see a drop in the services, and I don't hear of a decline in procedures or purchases of this drug. So if you have some data to give to the committee that supports your assertion that these individuals are afraid to buy the drugs and don't know where to source it from, I think that would be very helpful.
Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have hard data on the number of providers who might be concerned. I have a lot of anecdotal data. The board, as Representative Liebling mentioned, has been working with many different groups that represent practitioners and physicians. And we've talked directly to practitioners. We've talked directly to ophthalmologists, for example. And what we're hearing from them is, so this is more anecdotal, is that they're very worried about who to buy from. Now, there are some facilities out there. We have been helping people who come to us try to identify facilities, The other thing is there may indeed be more pain facilities opening for that sort of thing, but I really don't know what sort of procedures they might be doing and whether they're using commercially manufactured drugs versus compounded drugs. The other thing that we've heard, again, anecdotally, is whenever possible, providers are trying to use commercially available drugs, manufactured drugs, unless there's just no option. And then what they're trying to do is trying to figure out the best place to buy the ones that have to be compounded.
I'm going to defer to Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought it might be helpful if we could ask Mr. Weiberg to kind of, I imagine that most of the members of the committee don't have a lot more background on this than I do. Maybe some of you do, but maybe it would be helpful if he would explain what compounding is as opposed to other kinds of pharmaceuticals. That maybe we should have started there, but if he would do that, it would be helpful.
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, drug compounding is something that's really been a traditional part of pharmacy practice for centuries. But the way that's evolved over perhaps the last 50 to 75 years at least, with the advent of large-scale commercial manufacturing, is that compounding typically now is done patient by patient for the most part. It's done after the pharmacy gets a prescription for an individual patient. And that means it's done in very small quantities, typically. There's something else called anticipatory compounding, and that's where, and I give this example because I'm a pharmacist myself, used to practice in Red Wing. We had a dermatologist that would come into town two Thursdays a month, Doc Burris, and we would know that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we would be compounding one of the two types of topical creams he wanted. If we knew that we were going to do 10 prescriptions over that weekend, it would have been acceptable for us to make up a larger batch that we could divide into 10 doses. And basically, compounding is taking various ingredients, sometimes bulk chemicals, sometimes commercially manufactured drugs, and mixing them together in various ways to produce a new drug product. It's distinguished from manufacturing in that, first of all, if you're talking about large-scale manufacturing, it has to be done under the authority of the FDA. And the manufacturers are registered by the FDA, and they produce much, much larger quantities. They produce thousands of doses at a time. That difference of scale is critical, because if you're producing just a few batches at a time and something goes wrong, you have just a few patients that are affected. If you produce, like NEC was doing, hundreds of thousands of doses at a time and something goes wrong, then every single patient could be affected. One of the other differences that often happens is compounded products are often used much more quickly than manufactured products. They have a shorter shelf life. And so manufacturers have to follow more stringent quality control standards than compounders do, because the risk of what they're doing can be substantially greater. So that's kind of a distinction. And what NEC was doing and what facilities like NEC around the country are doing is really a hybrid. And this has been an issue that's been going on for 25 years. This is only the first in the string of dozens of incidents like this. This is getting so much attention because in past incidents, you were talking about 5 or 10 people affected, and this is just so many people affected, so many people died. And so Congress actually tried to deal with this back in 1997. There were a bunch of legal wrangling. The federal law is in limbo. And so the FDA, the boards of pharmacy, I think, around the country recognize there's a need to do something with these middle entities that are not really doing small-scale pharmacy compounding. They're not doing, you know, whole-scale manufacturing. They're doing something in between. And that's the regulatory niche we're trying to carve out at the federal and state level, to see how that can be done to address issues like drug shortage, but to be done to better standards than these sort of facilities like NEC have been following up to this point.
Representative Zerwas?
Yep. Okay, now just a specific question on page 2, line 2.21 through 2.25. It talks about a toll-free hotline between patients and pharmacists at the pharmacy who has access to the patient's records. So this bill is mandating that each pharmacy has a toll-free, a 1-800 number that patients can call 40 hours a week to talk.
Mr. Wyvern.
Madam Chair, Representative, this language is actually existing in current Board of Pharmacy rules, and it specifically addresses out-of-state pharmacies. So this is the large mail-order pharmacies, and this has been, again, in the rules for a very long time. And the idea here is if you go into a pharmacy in this state, if you have a question, you can usually pick up the phone and call your pharmacist down the block, at least during business hours, or you can maybe even go there. But for the large out-of-state mail-order pharmacies, the concern was, how does a patient get their question answered? Should they have to, pay for a phone call to this company? So this really applies to and has applied through the rules to these large email or mail-order pharmacies that ship into the state. They don't object to that. They all have this now. Okay. They don't have a problem with that.
All right. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on the answer that was just given, Dr. Weiberg, so if I have a friend who actually practices pharmacy in a nearby town to where you practice, he's a small independent, his understanding is that he is not going to be obligated to add a toll-free telephone service to his cost structure. That, and the reason that the question was brought up was from a standpoint of there's a difference, in my opinion, between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law when it is implied here that, you know, I appreciate your elaboration that this is for out-of-state, kind of the middle market wholesale, but it doesn't explicitly exclude or persuade the small independent pharmacy from having to adhere to that stipulation.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Representative Albright, if you look on line 2.14 of the bill, this applies to pharmacies located outside of the state.
Thank you.
If I might, Madam Chair.
Mr. Albright. This
provision was put in the rules specifically to make sure that the mail-order pharmacies were not having an advantage over the pharmacies in the state, that they could just get by without providing the level of services that local pharmacies had to provide.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Verhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the testimony. Mr. Wyvern, my comments are basically very similar to the previous two members. But is this patterned after other states in terms of the requirements? Are there other states that utilize this type of same framework?
Mr. Wyvern.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, if you're referring to the after-hours toll-free telephone number for out-of-state...
Well, just the changes in general.
The changes in general? Yes, it is. Certainly the after-hours toll-free number, that definitely is. Many, many states require that. I think that may be even in the Model Practice Act of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. Almost all states, not all, it turns out Massachusetts wasn't doing this, but almost all states require any pharmacy located in any other state that ships into their state to be licensed by the board. Almost all of them have requirements that they be licensed by the state they're located in. Fewer have requirements to submit inspection reports, although I think efforts are underway to across the country to be doing that now in the wake of this. But so, yes, this is very similar to what a lot of other states do.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, is the medical community on board with this, the doctors?
Mr. Wyvern.
With these changes?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, as Representative Liebling mentioned, we have had lengthy negotiations with the physician community over the last week or so, and they are okay with this bill as amended at this point, is what they have told me.
Representative,
last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. When I look at this, too, it seems like there's a lot of requirements. You say most of them are already in the Pharmacy Board of Policy or whatever it is. And, again, I'm a layperson, and we're simply moving them into statute. But to what, has there been an analysis of how much this will increase cost of drugs versus gain safety?
Mr. Wyvern.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, two things. First of all, some of the language was in rule, and we're moving it to statute. Some of what we have been doing has been happening. We have been asking for any facility we license to send in inspection reports, even though that is not a requirement in rule right now. And they have been doing that already. So that should not add much of a cost to any place that we license. The one cost that there might be is in the event that a pharmacy is located in a state that does not inspect their pharmacies. And again, after this neck crisis, I think more states are going to be doing that. If they're in that sort of a state and they can't provide an inspection report from their agency, they would have to pay an agent of the board to have that inspection done. However, most states do inspect pharmacies, so we think that that's actually going to be a fairly small number. I actually do not think there'd be much of an impact at all at cost.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Weiberg, right? I'm assuming that there is no fiscal note with this, because I don't see any indication that that's true.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Thank you. Then I'd like to make...
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then just kind of an editorial comment. We are trying so much to be efficient in government and minimize any extra, opportunities or facilities to be hiring people, paying government agencies. The FDA has notoriously been underfunded forever. And I don't know that that's going to change, but it seems to me that this is, you just described, states adding, having to do some more inspections. And if there's this middle category of manufacturers or producers, then there are going to be more inspections even in Minnesota. But we're not, it seems to me like we're asking more of the agency here, but not also adding any funding for that. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative, to clarify a little bit, this particular bill has no fiscal note. The reason this particular bill has no fiscal note is all of the health licensing boards have a separate appropriation bill. We've received permission from the governor's office and Minnesota Management and Budget to proceed in that manner. The Board of Pharmacy is going to be asking in that bill for an increase in appropriation of $210,000. We were going to ask for that at any rate. It's just we're going to repurpose some of the funding to hire an additional surveyor here. We actually wanted to have some of that funding to hire someone to do more policy work. Right now, I am the only person at the board who does policy work, and I'm the chief administrative officer of the agency. I have no fewer than 8 different legislative policy issues to work on right now. And then we were going to hire some additional clerical staff. So that we're going to repurpose some of the money we're asking for there to hire a new surveyor for the purpose not of doing inspections here, but of doing a more thorough review of those inspection reports that come into us from the other states.
Representative Boyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Weiberg. I just want to say thank you. I realize that we keep asking more with less, and I think that this is a good example of how we need some government in places to protect people and to provide the services that they need. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1136 be recommended to pass and place on the general register.
As amended, Madam Chair.
As amended, yes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passed. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Thank
Members, we have a little piece of business that I would like to take care of now, and then let's just take care of this business first. We need to clear some things up from earlier in the week and make sure that everyone's on the same page. And so in your packets, you should have House File 1114. And that bill is actually still before this committee, and so I would like to entertain a motion to reconsider that House File 1114.
Madam Chair.
Is there Representative Albright?
I'd like to make a motion to reconsider.
All right. Representative Albright moves to reconsider House File 1114. And members, this is the OIG bill that we've... This is probably the most considered bill in this committee this year. And we just had some missteps with the bill and needed to amend it and had brought it back and done that, but everybody didn't really get a chance to. We didn't have the bill before us at the time in terms of the paper in our packets. And everybody didn't get a chance to understand what was going on and perhaps vote the way they actually intended to vote on this bill. So... is there any discussion on the motion to reconsider?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was one of the people that was out of the room yesterday, and so I guess if we could maybe just run through briefly, and Representative Abler isn't here, who I know made the motion to amend, and to be honest, I can't remember if we had a piece of paper in front of us or if it was just an oral amendment, but if maybe you or staff or someone could just run us through exactly what change yesterday so we know what we're revoting on, that would be very helpful.
Okay, thank you. Well, first should we take a vote on whether to reconsider, because it's not actually before us, Representative Mack. So all those in favor of the motion to reconsider, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. So 1114 is back before us. And Representative Abler is the author of this bill, and unfortunately he's not able to be here today, but This is the OIG bill, and it has sections in it that deal with set-asides, or it did anyway, for people who work in human services. And there was an intention to delete the article that changes the current law on set-asides. And in the original, as the bill had been passed, it contained some language that members weren't fully aware of at the time and fully comfortable with, and so the intention was to simply remove any changes that related to that part of law. So that is what we had done when the bill was before us before, and I know that members, and I apologize to Representative Mack and members, that at that time we did not have a piece of paper in our packets explaining that, and people were kind of, and I know that we had finished another contentious bill and people were kind of going in and out of the room, and I just wanted to make sure that members had an opportunity to be on record voting the way they actually wanted to be voting and not just kind of making an error not knowing what was going on. So that was the intention in bringing that before us today. So,
Madam Chair.
Who's speaking?
Representative
Ward.
Just for a clarification, I have a question.
Please, Representative Ward.
Are we looking at... an amendment of this, or are we looking at the original bill?
Okay. All right. We are on the bill right now has the DE amendment in it, and that's in your packet, so that is the 1104 amendment that is in your packet. So that is what we're looking at right now. Okay, and is Article 5 in this DE amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So we are in on this DE amendment, and we're looking at Article 5, which is the background study portion. And so I would, with the bill before us, with the background study portion in there, I would entertain a motion to reconsider. We could reconsider the amendment to delete that section, and then we can make a new motion to delete that section so that everybody's clear that, you know, if people want to vote to delete that section, that everyone who wants to be on record doing that can be on record doing that. Okay, am I pretty clear?
Yep.
So I would then like to entertain a motion to reconsider the amendment that was previously made. Representative Albright, would you like to make that motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make that motion.
All right. All those in favor of that reconsideration, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, the motion prevails, and so that motion is back before us. So now we need to know if someone would like to move to remove that article. So the motion would be to strike Article 5, which is the background studies article and does some things that at this time some members may not be comfortable with in this bill. So is there a motion to do that?
Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
I would move to strike Article 5 from the Delete All Amendment for House File 1114.
Okay, so Representative Mack moves to strike Article 5 from the bill as it is right now, which is the amendment that's before us, the 0104 amendment. And Representative Mack, would you like a roll call on that motion?
I would like a roll call. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A roll call having been requested. The clerk will call the roll on the motion to strike Article 5. And this is the article that makes changes to the background study portion of the bill that contains some language that members were not comfortable with. And is there any discussion to that motion? Representative Mack.
Madam Chair, just wanted to say thank you for reconsidering and getting this issue cleared up. Really appreciate it, and thank you for that.
And thank you, Representative Mack, for working with me on this. So the clerk will call the roll.
Chair Liebling?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moran?
Yes.
Lead Representative Tara Mack?
Yes.
Representative Abler? Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Allen? Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Franson?
Yeah.
Representative Fritz?
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Huntley?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler? Aye. Representative Lomer?
Yes.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Mullery?
Aye.
Representative Schoen?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Yes.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Representative Zerwas?
Yes.
There being 17 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails. And then, and members, so I'm going to move that House File 1144 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services.
1114.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. Got a little typo here on my, okay. House File 1114. Thank you, Representative Mack. And now, before I do that, I just want to comment, members, that this issue about the set-asides and background studies, and you heard we had one member vote no on removing this, and this is not a cut-and-dried issue. This is a very difficult issue, and I just want to say that in removing this article, this is an area of policy that we really do need to struggle with, and by our removing it and by my doing this, I in no way mean to imply that I think the law is perfect as it is. I think that's really clear. There are some issues here that do need to be dealt with. It's just that in the press of this session and the way this came through and without really proper consideration and vetting by members, it just seemed to us, I think bipartisanly, that we just weren't able to take it on in this form this year. And so I hope that members will continue to struggle with this. Perhaps next year we can revisit this issue and have a really more deliberative discussion. Representative Huntley.
My particular interest in this is
a lot of us do stupid things when we're 16 years old, and sometimes we get convicted of something, and we go on and lead the rest of our lives fine, and turns out that in some cases then that person is prevented from, even though they get educated to become a LPN or a nurse, they then find out they can't work as an LPN or a nurse 10 years later. And so that's my concern about this issue.
Right. Thank you, Representative Huntley. And I think Representative Huntley's kind of articulated some of the concerns on the other side of this. And that's why this is such a difficult issue, because this has to do with who can we entrust with taking care of our vulnerable citizens. And when is it appropriate to allow someone to put their past behind them? And when can we have confidence that somebody who did something wrong in the past can then be safely trusted to be working with our vulnerable citizens? So clearly, this is something that is very controversial. We have that tension between being fair to people who need to be able to work and earn a living and may have made a mistake in their past, with the very important value of keeping our vulnerable population safe. So that's kind of the discussion here, and as I said before, that's why we're simply moving forward to take it out right now, because we need to do this with a scalpel rather than an axe, and I hope that we'll be able to revisit that sometime in the very near future. So thank you, members, for your indulgence. So with that, I will move that House File 1114 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you, members. That passes, and hopefully we won't have to hear that bill again in this committee this session. So now, members, what I'd like to do is take a recess. It's now 11:30. I would like to, I'm going to say 20 minutes to please be back here in the room. The DFL members will be caucusing. Do you have a place where you can caucus? Okay, and we'll, Ms. Sando is going to find us a room to caucus in here in a moment. And if maybe, I don't know what GOP members, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. GOP members will caucus in 208 immediately following the move to recess.
And so we will try to get back here about 10 minutes to noon, and then we will take up the final bill that's on our agenda, which is House File 588. And we will, if DFL members will just hang on for a second, we'll figure out what room we're going to be in. So we are in recess. All right. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. Obviously, it's taken a little bit longer. Sometimes, the stew needs to cook a little while before it's ready to eat, and I think that's what we've been doing here. I'm all full of food analogies this session. I don't know.
No more soup.
At least it's stew now, Representative Zerwas. So.
More soup?
It must be lunchtime. So, members, I'm going to, first of all, I'm going to move, or since Representative Atkins is before us with House File 588, and I'm going to move, for Representative Atkins, I'm going to move House File 588, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And then, members, I think everybody knows, it's no secret here, that this has been a very contentious issue. It's been contentious not just this session, but for a very long time. And we have what we hope is kind of a negotiated, if not a solution, I don't want to overstate where we are, but the parties have been working very hard to come to some kind of place where we can move forward on this together, because this is an issue that in we as a committee, as a health policy committee, have a lot of concerns here. Our primary concern is the health and well-being of patients, and there is, of course, some contention, some disagreement about how we can best assure the health and well-being of patients. But for us as a health committee, I think that we would all agree that that is our top concern here. And I'm going to, we have before us the 028 amendment. And before I move this, I'm going to incorporate a change on this amendment, and that would be on line 2.12. We're going to put a period after the word unit and then strike the rest of that sentence and strike the sentence on 2.13. So I'm incorporating that change on the amendment that is before you. Did everybody understand that change?
Yep. Madam Chair, could you just repeat it one more time, please?
Certainly. The incorporation is on line 2.12 after the word unit to put a period there, strike the rest of the sentence, and then strike the rest of the next sentence on 2.13 is stricken.
The whole sentence all the way down to 2.6?
No. Just line 2.12 after the word unit and the line on 2.13. Does everybody have that? Okay, members, everyone has that change. Okay, so that's what I'm incorporating here. And so I'm going to move to adopt this amendment and put this delete everything amendment on the bill, and then we will discuss what we're doing here and before we vote on the bill as amended. So I would move the 028 amendment with the incorporated change. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, members, before I go to Representative Atkins, I just want to have you take a look at what you've got before you. And this has to do with what's in this amendment is some language about doing some reporting on hospital staffing and in addition having a study with the Department of Health to convene a work group to study the correlation between nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes. I think we're going to hear from Representative Atkins. I'm actually going to give him a chance to speak on his own bill here in a minute.
I think I'm doing really well so far, man.
This is what I learned as a young lawyer, Representative Atkins, when the judge is making your case, just shut up, yeah. Right?
You'll notice I'm following well, Mr. Chair.
But I think there's broad agreement that we need to do something in this area. There is a problem. And one of the things I think there's broad agreement on is that we do need to do some studying of the problem, because we have a hospital system where there is not just one. We have various kinds of hospitals, and those hospitals don't all function the same. This is not a various kinds of hospitals, and those hospitals don't all function the same. This is not a one-size-fits-all situation. And part of what we need to know is to understand if we have a problem with patient safety, if we do, where that problem lies, and to help us get to some really good policy to address real issues that may exist. And so I think we want to study, and this study language is, I just want to say, this is in no way to be considered a final resolution of the issues that are before us in this bill. I want to say that again, neither side believes that this is a final resolution. But we're going in the right direction. We've got some reporting and some study of the further issues. And I think members of this committee understand that even reporting when it comes to hospitals is not a simple one-size-fits-all thing. There are a lot of issues around the way data is collected, the way it's reported, and what we want to do here, at least what I want to do, is get to a point where consumers, patients, can get a really clear view of which hospitals are getting good outcomes which are not getting such good outcomes, and to the degree that staffing impacts those outcomes, they should be able to see what the staffing levels are and how they interplay with all of this. And this is going to take some much more detailed work and work by the parties to get to a place where we can really say, yes, this is the right method. So this amendment and the bill as it is now, I think, represents some really hard work on the part of both sides, for which I really want to commend everybody. And I also am going to request that everybody please, nobody is being let off the hook here today with this language, where we are absolutely requesting and expecting the parties to continue working on the details so that this session we can actually enact something that will move us forward to ensure that we have transparency and patient safety across the state. With that, Representative, maybe you'd like to address your bill. I think you did a lot of your talking last night. I'm trying to get you off
the
hook.
Former colleague, Representative Yaros, would say it's a good bill. Please vote green. But that's my best Croatian or Slavic impression. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this is this has been a difficult issue for many years in this body, but there's some things that we uniformly agree on, and that is, and I wouldn't be carrying this bill if I didn't agree about that too, and that is, as you said, Madam Chair, it's about patient safety. And I think everybody involved wants to make sure that that occurs. Well, this may not, as you said, Madam Chair, be the final solution. It does, in fact, bring both parties considerably closer to each other. And reporting and studying and making sure that we're basing this on what the real facts are, I don't think anybody could argue with that either. And with that, I don't think there's anything further to be added to what the chair said. I would appreciate support for this bill as amended. Madam Chair, I will turn it back to you unless members happen to have questions.
Okay, thank you, Representative Atkins. And I think we may have one testifier on the bill, and so I'm not sure who that's going to be, but I would ask them to approach if they know who they are. And of course, we never prevent anybody from testifying on a bill if they so choose, but welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Massa. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association. We appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. We also appreciate the author, the Minnesota Nurses Association, all of the people that have worked on this language for moving away from mandated staffing ratios. As you know, that's been our biggest concern with this bill from the beginning, and we continue to believe that moving staffing decisions away from the bedside based on the needs of actual patients being cared for is a dangerous precedent and bad policy. The compromise language is fairly new, as you would guess. We have talked about some reporting language with our members. This goes further than the discussion that we've had. So we certainly are open to continuing the discussion on transparency and reporting. As always, the devil is in the details. So we're going to need to vet this with our members and seek additional input. But we think this is a step in the right direction. You talked about earlier focusing on outcomes. I think the study is certainly something we can work with. We have testified many times that we achieve pretty good outcomes here in Minnesota at Minnesota hospitals when you look at national statistics. Yet we have the varying degrees of opinion about how we're getting to that. So I think looking at outcomes will continue to be the right approach. And as we implement healthcare reform and try to bring costs under control, processes are going to evolve and change. So I think continuing to make sure there's a strong focus on outcomes in terms of how we measure things is a really good idea. So we can work with the amendment as presented, and we appreciate everyone's work in making that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Massa. Representative Grunhagen.
I'll pass right now. I'll wait till the any other testifiers.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none.
Well, that must be like there.
Right? Representative Grunhagen.
All right, just so we're basically reducing the bill down to a study. Is that the correct understanding?
No.
There's more than that.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen.
Representative Atkins.
Briefly, no, it's not just a study, although the study is a critical component, and that's reflected in the Chair's amendment starting on lines 2.14.
Yep.
But there's also some reporting, and I'll let the language speak for itself, but most of it's contained in the, well, basically on page 2. Some core staffing plan disclosure, or development and disclosure, and then on the website, starting in subdivision 3 there, the core staffing plan will be on the Minnesota Hospital Association's Minnesota Hospital Quality Report website, with substantial changes to the core staffing plan updated within 30 days, and then also including on the website for each reporting hospital on a quarterly basis the actual direct patient care hours per patient and per unit.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, I do have some comments, but I want to wait to see. I think there's some amendments coming, or I don't know if there are or not, but otherwise I've got some final questions when we're ready to vote on the final product.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, I know that some amendments had been drafted, but there has been quite a bit of negotiation between the parties here. And this is kind of a, and Representative Grunhagen, the amendments were to the original bill, I'm reminded. We've now put on this delete all. So those amendments really pretty much no longer apply.
Oh, okay.
And of course, any member can offer an amendment, but I think the sides here are, I think what we're hearing is that people are reasonably comfortable with this
both
and ready
sides.
To move forward. Both sides. So Representative Atkins, of course, the bill came from the Minnesota Nurses Association. He is the author of that bill, so he's, I believe, speaking for that side. And then you just heard from the other side that they're reasonably comfortable with moving this forward. So,
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions, members? Okay. Seeing none, I think we're ready to actually vote on this issue. I think we should release confetti or something, Representative Atkins.
There'd be white smoke going up.
White smoke. There you go. All right, so I will renew my motion that House File 588, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you. Madam.
Thank you, members. And thank you to those in the room. And we are adjourned.